Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Hillel Fuld. He's an Israeli entrepreneur and writer. This is Technotopia. This episode of Technotopia is sponsored by CheapTranscription.io. CheapTranscription offers 10 cent per minute transcription using our happy robots or 85 cents per minute using our human assistants. CheapTranscription.io is cheaper and faster than everyone else. CheapTranscription.io. This episode of Technotopia is brought to you by Typewriter.plus. Typewriter.plus is a full-service editorial agency that brings amazing editors from places like the New York Times and TechCrunch to work on your writing. Need a blog post, a white paper, a presentation? The Typewriter team can write or edit anything on nearly any topic. Visit them at typewriter.plus for a free quote. That's typewriter.plus, typewriter.plus. Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs, and today on the show we have Hillel Fuld. He's an old friend. We've known each other for years. What do you do, Hillel? Tell the folks.
How long do we have, John?
We have about 20 minutes. We can expand this one to 22 minutes if you want.
I'm just saying you're asking the hardest the hardest question off the bat. I could spend the entire 22 minutes. I don't know what I do. I'm trying to figure it out. But if I'm going to simplify it, I guess I wear four hats. Hat number one is startups. I work with a lot of companies on growth. Hat number two is content. I write for a lot of publications and I do a daily vlog about tech and Israeli tech specifically. Hat number three is I work with a lot of enterprises in like a formal / ambassador / influencer. I hate these words, and I'm sure you do too, so you'll forgive me, but capacity. So I work with Google, I work with Huawei, I work with Microsoft, I work with Oracle. And, you know, it's not like a paid gig, but, you know, I'm an official, let's call it. Oracle calls it Startup Advisory Board, and Google calls it Google Developer Experts. They all call it something else. And the last final hat is I do a lot of public speaking around the world about Israeli tech, about marketing, startups, and a little bit about my story, which is little bit of a weird story that makes absolutely no sense from a traditional business perspective.
So what I want to talk to you about, I think, is the growth of outside places into prominence in terms of technology, in terms of politics, in terms of culture. A lot of folks that I talk to, they come from, I don't know, Bucharest, they come from Prague, they come from places where they feel like they're being ignored. How do you think Israel and Israeli startups get the most attention? And what does the future look like for smaller places on the map that might not be traditional power centers?
Right. It's a good question. So I think there's obviously a lot of literature about this. Just, you know, how did Israel become this technology superpower, for lack of a better term, given that it's a country smaller than New Jersey and the most, you know, the worst neighborhood on Earth, basically the most unstable region on planet Earth.
It's almost very similar to New Jersey in that respect.
Right. you know, I think there's not one right answer, obviously, but there are a lot of factors here. And I think, just to answer your question, I think if Israel can become what it's become in terms of innovation, and I think anyone can. Just, you know, you need those elements. So just to name a couple of you know, factors here. Number one, I think that the mindset or the culture of Israelis, as you know very well, John, you've been here a lot of times, is kind of like, you know, in a normal place, and you know, you're in New York, so let's put New York aside for one second. But in a normal place in the world, when you put your blinker on the road, the guy or the woman in the next lane is expected to slow down and let you into their lane. In Israel, when you put your blinker on, the person in the next lane speeds up, because the way Israelis think is, I'm going to let you into my lane. What's in it for me? Which sounds funny, and I'm saying it maybe half jokingly, but it's actually a real cultural thing. In Israel, they call it being a friar. In English, I guess the closest translation is being a sucker. It's like the worst thing for an Israeli to be is to be a sucker. And you know, when you tell an Israeli entrepreneur you can't do something, all they hear is, all right, I'm doing, like, you're challenging me, game on. And so, you know, you see there are so many products, you see so many startups in this country that are just so out of the box and so outrageous. You know, I would imagine you probably heard of this company, just to name one kind of very extreme example. If you look at the printers of, you know, 2020, if you look at like all of the devices we've used, they've all evolved, right? And we're carrying around a supercomputer in our pockets. And here we have this printer that sits by our computer. It's this big clunky machine. It hasn't evolved. It's still like, oh, I got to print something. You got to like go and dust off your printer. It's a pain. And like you say to yourself, like, why haven't printers evolved? And the answer is fairly straightforward. The answer is that a printer needs to be the size of a piece of paper. It can't be smaller because you got to put the paper into the printer. So that's how normal people think. Comes along an Israeli entrepreneur and says, wait a second, why do you even need to put the paper into the printer? And he built a mobile robotic printer that's a tiny little machine that you put on top of a piece of paper and it walks on the paper and prints, which is just outrageous. Like, who even thinks that way? And the answer is that's how Israeli entrepreneurs think. They don't even see the box. And so that's definitely factor number one. There is the element of the government, you know, playing a very active role in encouraging entrepreneurship in Israel, whether it's the Innovation Authority and, you know, the Chief Scientist's Office, where they basically give companies equity-free money to, you know, encourage innovation. So that's definitely an important part of it. There is the military, which, you know, the IDF is extremely, extremely innovative, you know, body, and the 8200 unit, the intelligence units in the Army, a lot of entrepreneurs that you and I know well came from there. That's definitely another component. And I think, you know, if I'm going to get a little heavy, maybe a little historical for one second, I think that the nation, the Jewish people, throughout our history, we kind of had to, you know, use any resources we had at our disposal to survive. And now that we're kind of in Israel, we have, you know, the ability to defend ourselves for the first time. We kind of are taking that energy we previously used in survivor mode, and we're repurposing it to make the world a better place. And those are some of the components, I think, that led to kind of Israel being such a tech superpower. And so the answer is, I think anybody in theory, at least, could duplicate that and, you know, work on the culture, work on the government. These are all things that can be in theory duplicated, maybe except for the last one, that, you know, your history is your history. But I do think that, you know, with the right infrastructure, there's really no stopping any geography from becoming a technology, at least a significant player in the technology space.
I think of all that, I think the interest, the idea of interest-free and almost free investment from the government is fairly important. But how do you avoid government interference in technology, or is that a bad thing or a good thing?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it ties back to the cultural thing. In other words, I think the government realizes the importance of technology and innovation for the Israeli economy and just for the state as a whole. And so it's really an aligned interest. I think everyone wants, you know, Israel to excel in technology, and it's really a win-win. There's no loss here. And so, yes, you know, in the short term, when the government's giving you free money, obviously they're losing quote unquote money, but at the end of the day, it comes back in spades. And, you know, just to give you one example, about a year ago, I'm estimating it was around a year ago, but it was a while ago, the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post came over to me, actually in synagogue on Sabbath, and said to me, you know, Hillel, you contribute to TechCrunch, you write for Inc., you write for all these places. What about us? How come you don't write for the Jerusalem Post? I said to him, what do you have in mind? He said, listen, I'll build you the Hillel's Tech Corner on the front page of the business section, and you could feature a startup every week. And I said, great, sounds good. And then I went home that day and I said to myself, what the hell did I just commit to? I don't have extra time to write another piece every week. I'm like, you know what? If I'm going to do this, I'm going to do something unique. I'm not going to write about Waze and Mobileye because enough have written about this stuff. Enough people have written about these companies. I'm going to write about impact. I'm going to write about Israeli companies that are literally changing the world on the impact side. And I'll tell you, John, I honestly did not know what I was getting into because I didn't know it's not my space. So I didn't know if there are 5 companies, 10 companies, 100 companies, 1,000. I had no idea what I was doing. But I started to do some research, and I'm telling you, man, my inbox looks like World War III. The amount of companies that are pitching me to be in this column right now, and every single one of them, without exception, every single one of them is deeply, deeply impactful. I mean, this week I'm writing about a vaccine for Corona, but, you know, whether it's last week I wrote about a new technology that's going to basically disrupt the whole hearing aid space. I wrote about a company that purifies the air, makes rooms military grade, you know, the air pure. I've written about, obviously, many cancer companies. I've written about companies that make, you know, ICUs more efficient. I've written about companies that are disrupting the urine test, right? Healthy.io that makes, you know, lets you take a urine test without the awkwardness of walking through your doctor's office holding a glass of urine or a cup of urine. I mean, it's literally endless. I've written, I don't know how many hundreds of articles already about Israeli companies that are having an impact. And so these are companies, and by the way, to be very clear, I'm not talking about nonprofits. I'm talking about full-blown tech companies.
Sure.
So the government, like when Israel's leading the way and, you know, working on cures and on treatments for cancer and on vaccines for corona, like everyone gains here. And so, yeah, in the short term, they are quote unquote investing in the future of this country. But in the long term, it's really just a classic win-win situation.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's actually an interesting... I think about this a lot, the idea of the friar. And friar, there's a lot of... That translates well into Slavic and German, obviously. And it's kind of like fool or sucker, I guess you could say. And maybe this doesn't quite work in what we're talking about, but I think there's the attitude in some European countries, especially, if you're a success, you're a crook. If you're a failure, you're a sucker, for example, you're a friar, right? How do you break that? How do you break that idea? And I think to a degree that kind of happens in Israel as well. But it's actually very, very debilitating, especially for a certain generation of entrepreneur. The older entrepreneurs in Central Europe just have that same attitude, where they'll burn each other down and quicker than they build each other up. I don't think the younger ones are in the same position. And I think it's an interesting cultural point.
Yes, I'll tell you the truth. I mean, not to sound too cynical, but I've kind of capitalized on this because I've built my whole entire career, and I say this, you know, I've written articles about this, and I say it, but I it sounds like a joke, but I mean it. I've built my career on being a friar, on being a sucker, because, you know, most people don't know this about me. You probably know it because I've sent you 1,000 stories over the years, and I tell you, these guys aren't paying me. And, you know, just like I sent you stories, I've sent Mark Andreessen deals. I've sent investors, hundreds of investors deals that I don't take finder's fees. And so, you know, 90% or 95% of the time that I spend with startups or helping companies or helping entrepreneurs is completely unmonetized. Nobody pays me a dime. And what happens is I found that when I focus my time and resources on value, and I know that the word value has become somewhat of a cliche, but what I mean is when I focus my time and resources on helping startups win, and that could mean help with social media, help with PR, help with business development, help with fundraising, whatever it may be. When I focus my time and resources on that, and the recipient of that value is not paying me, what happens is they have no expectations, right? Because they're not paying me. I owe them nothing. Now, if I owe them nothing and I'm giving them that value, all I can do is exceed expectations. Now, when I exceed expectations over and over and over again with these guys, what I create is what I like to call delight. It's delightful. Like, here's this Hillel guy. I'm not paying him. He owes me nothing. And he's actually gone out and really leveraged his relationships to help me. Now, here's the kicker. And again, this is going to sound super cynical, but delight is easy to monetize, right? You think about things in your life that make you happy. A good cup of coffee, who wouldn't pay for a good cup of coffee? And so when entrepreneurs come to me with like hearts in their eyes because I just raised them $15 million and they said to me, take 5%. And I said, absolutely not. They come to me, they're like, dude, you're unbelievable. That's when we can talk money. And so I've really gone all in on the friar thing. Like I thrive on this stuff. I love sitting with entrepreneurs, helping them. Now, to be clear, I'm not like an idiot. I don't spend, you know, hours and months on entrepreneurs that aren't paying me. But like, if I could have a lunch with a guy and make an introduction to John Biggs or to make an introduction to some, you know, investor or whoever it may be, what am I actually losing? Like, not very much. And I'm going to read you an email that I got many, many years ago from a startup in Palo Alto, which shall remain unnamed right now because I'm not sure how sensitive it is, and I don't know if they want to be named. But this is from a founder of a company that is worth billions of dollars that I loved the product from day one. I promoted them. I did my thing, like, just because I really genuinely loved them. I helped them a lot. I flew out to the Valley. I sat with the team. And again, the thought of asking this company in Silicon Valley that has literally a multi-billion dollar valuation, thought of asking them for anything did not even cross my mind for a split second. I promise you that. Like, who the hell am I? It didn't even cross my mind. I'm reading you word for word the email that I got from the CEO. The subject of the email is thank you. He writes, "Hello, I won't ever forget your enduring support for what we have been building over the years. It's time we got you some stock and asked you to be a formal advisor. I know you wouldn't ask for this, but it's the right thing to do. I hope you'll accept. We are only just beginning and I can really use your advice when you have the time. All the best." Now, this is one email that I got, you know, out of literally, and I'm not exaggerating, hundreds of emails like that. That it was a company that I helped because I could help them. You know, how long does it take to make an introduction to an investor? Not that long. And so I made these introductions. I tried to help, and it's turned into, like, not that I'm some kind of big success story, but I have this portfolio of companies. Now it's approaching probably 30 by now that have come to me. I've never come to a company in my life and said, "Here's my deck. Here's my offering. I have a team. I have an agency." I never had that. I don't have a team. I don't have an agency. I'm one guy. And, you know, turns out when you're, you know, providing this value to people and not asking for anything in return, you're actually doing something that I believe is highly underrated in business. And that's building trust. You're building trust. Trust is easy to monetize. When people trust you and they view you in a delightful manner, you can monetize that. Not in a mean, you know, nasty kind of way, but in a mutually beneficial kind of way. And so, you know, this thing of being a friar is, on the one hand, like, it gets you ahead in business. I mean, in technology, in business, mm-hmm. It's the worst thing in the world. You got to let people into your lane. You got to build relationships. You got to build trust. And so the fact that, you know, so many are kind of allergic to that being a friar thing has helped me in my career, because I've capitalized on it, because I've fundamentally differentiated myself from literally everyone in this country. So I'm loving it.
I think we this turns into a different podcast. This turns into Hillel's PR, Hillel's startup advice. What are you going to be in Israel in 20 years, or is Israel going to exist as a separate country? Do countries exist in 20 years?
Oh, I mean, listen, you're talking to me. I don't know if you know this, but it's Independence Day in Israel today, Yom Ha'atzmaut. Mm-hmm. And you're talking to a guy who left, you know, well, I was 15 when I came here, but you're talking to a guy who's part of a family that left New York, you know, living the dream over there, and came to move to Israel. And sorry to get super heavy on you right now, and to a guy whose brother was murdered in a terrorist attack.
Of course, 100%.
So I'm all in on this Israel thing, man. I love this country, like, you know, deep. And I think it's a remarkable country, both in terms of what we've accomplished in 72 years, but also in terms of, again, like a historical perspective. You know, it's a remarkable thing. You're talking about a nation that, you know, always had to fight persecution, you know, whether it was the Spanish Inquisition or the Holocaust, or whatever it may be. And here we are coming home to a modern state of Israel for the first time in thousands and thousands of years. And, you know, the Nazis couldn't get us down. The Spanish couldn't get us down. The pogroms couldn't get us down. You know, and again, I don't know if we want to go into your politics, but the Palestinians ain't taking us down. So is Israel going to be here in 20 years? Israel's going to be here for a lot longer than 20 years, and I'll be here loud and proud.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not meaning it's going to be wiped off the face of the earth. I'm meaning is the idea of a country as it stands now going to be a thing in the future?
That's a fascinating question, I think.
And I think it's a hard question, because, I mean, you love Israel. I enjoy living in New York. I enjoy living in New York right now, especially considering our president. But it's in the future, you could see a way that you could be Israeli, but you wouldn't have a country per se, because A, we're not maybe on this planet that much, and B, the idea of borders becomes meaningless in a connected world.
Well, I'll tell you this. In theory, I agree with what you're saying, I guess, globally. When it comes to Israel, we're in a little bit of a unique situation. Again, you got to look at it not in an abyss, but look at it from a historical perspective. I don't think that the Jewish people can survive without a home. Meaning, you know, again, you'll forgive me, I'm getting super heavy on this podcast today, but I don't know if you saw your mayor's tweet yesterday. Did you see what he tweeted? Mm-mm. He tweeted to the Jewish community and to all communities, just know that gatherings now are illegal, and we will arrest, you know, I've instructed NYPD to arrest. He literally called out the Jewish community. Like, I mean, dude, like that. I mean, given everything, you know, if the Jewish people had not already gone through all the persecution we've gone through, like singling out the Jewish people, you know, because we gather to pray together. All right, maybe I could buy that, but like a little sensitivity, man. I'm not gonna go down the anti-Semitic route and call it. I'm not calling any names, but like it's a dangerous world out there to be Jewish. I mean, the number of hate crimes against Jews is exponentially. It's growing. You wouldn't believe. I mean, you look at Europe. It's completely.
Sure.
You know, mainstream hatred in Parliament. It's wild, and so I don't see Israel not having very, very clear borders just for the sake of like protecting us from our enemies that are coming in all directions. I mean, you know, it's a wild thing that, and again, getting super, I'm going to keep apologizing, but it's a wild thing that there's an entire people called the Palestinians, a term that was invented in 1967 by an objective terrorist, Yasser Arafat. That's not, so far I have not expressed an opinion. He was a terrorist. He invented this thing called the Palestinian Arabs, which was never a thing. There was never a Palestinian Arab country. Like, again, so far not expressed an opinion. Never happened in history that there was a Palestinian Arab country. He invented this thing called Palestinians. The charter of the PLO, the charter of the Palestinian people is literally no Israel, meaning they don't have a positive identity. Their identity is we need to wipe Israel off the map. And so how does a country, how do we as a nation exist in a world without borders when we are surrounded? I mean, I just named the Palestinians, but obviously Iran is warheads that literally say on the warhead, wipe Israel off the map. So we kind of need these borders.
Okay. All right. I want to do another one. I want to do a follow-up with you. I want to talk about the concept of religion in the future. As a techno-utopianist and an atheist, it's hard to see the value, but you definitely do see the value. And I love that about you as well.
I appreciate that. So I have a very interesting perspective on religion. I got to be honest with you. So my dad's a rabbi. He's a rabbi, but not a rabbi that you would expect the rabbi to look. He's a very liberal by all standards, very open-minded rabbi, but an orthodox one, meaning he's open-minded to a certain limit. And I grew up in a house of educators. Both my parents are educators, and in a deeply religious and observant home, you know, Sabbath and kosher and everything. And I'm sure you've seen this, I very much try to take a global perspective and angle on my religion. So what I do, for example, is I learn with my kids, usually once a week, the Torah portion, and I take that lesson that I taught them and I apply it to business, and I usually share it on Facebook and I share it with people that are deeply secular, deeply, you know, atheist, et cetera. And I've had people, you know, hundreds, if not more, of people reach out to me and say to me, you know, your religious lessons have inspired me. And I say to them, but you don't even believe in God. They're like, it doesn't even matter. It's such a global lesson that you can learn. And so, you know, religion and the faith and belief in God is one thing, but the wisdom in religion, specifically Judaism, and the wisdom in the Torah and the morality in the Torah is, in my opinion, just an objective thing. And I think that anyone can gain from it if they're not afraid to embrace it. Meaning, you know, once you say, oh, I'm going to learn the Torah, then most people will say, okay, that means I need to keep Sabbath. Well, okay, you can just learn the Torah as a mental exercise. I'm not saying you have to be an observant Jew tomorrow, but usually most people kind of associate those things. To me, religion and specifically Judaism is the most beautiful thing in the world. I think there's just so many unbelievable commandments and intricacies and nuances to the religion that I think can be learned globally, no matter what your kind of belief or lack thereof in God is.
All right. Hello. I love it. I wish this were longer and we had a little more time, but I think we can bring you back on and we can keep going after all this pandemic stuff's over.
John, I got to tell you, I was super flattered when you asked me. I don't need to tell you this, but I'll tell it to you anyway. I've been a big fan of your work for a very long time, so it really is an honor to come on here.
Thanks, buddy. This has been Technotopia. I'm John Biggs. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Technotopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people. Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com.